Good afternoon. And, oh, mic is way down. Okay. So, last time we introduced this stack smashing pattern. So this idea that when we have an overflow on the stack, that there's this kind of generic way of exploiting it, where we can overwrite a return address, we can make that return address point typically back to our stack. And this means that, you know, every single buffer overflow on the stack at the time that this vulnerability was discovered, we'll talk either later today or next time about some things which make this not as generic anymore. But at the time, original time, like there's this generic pattern where all you need to know is that it's a buffer overflow on the stack, and you can turn that into running arbitrary code. So we overwrite the return address, we point to what is often called shellcode, because a common thing it would do is run a shell, run a command prompt, that is, in the input. And we mentioned, you know, there were some practical issues. And one practical issue was, you know, that finding the address where we put the shellcode was kind of tricky. That even without any explicit mitigations, it just varied because of things going on in the program, right? Even if we have a consistent initial stack pointer, different amount of stuff gets pushed onto the stack. And we mentioned kind of one technique for dealing with this called NOP sleds, where we just have a bunch of NOP instructions, and we can set our return address pointer to point anywhere on that bunch of NOP instructions, and it will still work. And if we can make this bunch of NOP instructions long enough, so we can have this really long, what's typically called a NOP sled, we have a lot of leeway for getting that return address value wrong. So questions on things we covered last time? Okay, so I'd like to make a logistical note on the obfuscate assignment. So there's a solution pattern which can be made to work, but if you try it in a certain way, it might appear to work and actually breaks the program. So please make sure that the assignment says, make it so it accepts any password and lets you play the game. Please make sure you didn't break the game. And I would recommend at least make sure you can enter in a coordinate into the game when it runs. If you can't do that, you did not solve it correctly because you broke the game. And there's a common solution pattern where entering a coordinate in will not work no matter what coordinate you choose. And that means you've broken something. As a hint, probably because the thing you modified is used in two places, not just one. And I gather from overhearing people, I need to communicate this to my TAs better, which I will try to do after this lecture. Right. We don't expect you to like play test the game, but we want the game to not be very broken by your changes, because you know the trivial version of the assignment just says you got the right password, exit, and we don't want you to do that. Okay, so questions on obfuscate assignment in general? So we're going to look at our attack for implementing stack smashing. So these are our steps. We write our shellcode, the machine code we want to execute. We identify the memory address, you know, of the shellcode in the buffer, and we overwrite the return address value. So I guess first I'll talk about kind of maybe the most prominent example of like real of this exploit, which was the original Morris worm. So the Morris worm was probably the first well-known internet worm. Got its author in a lot of trouble. And it had, among the things it did a buffer overflow exploit on a remote service called Finger D. So Finger is a command for shelling, getting a record of sort of contact information for someone on a remote server that was popular in the internet at the time. And the server daemon for this used DNS. So basically, when there was a connection from the network, it would run this program with standard in coming from the network, standard out going to the network, and use DNS on that. And this meant you could do a buffer overflow that overwrites a return address, and that is precisely what the Morris worm did. It set up this buffer where it filled in the return address, and actually the return address and other stuff that was pushed and popped from the stack. It overwrote the stuff that was pushed to the stack, including the return address and some other things with values chosen based on what the stack layout would be. And it had this machine code here that it wrote to the buffer. And then it sent that to the server over a socket. And it would jump when it returned from the function that called getS back to this shellcode, and the shellcode executed a shell. It was literally shellcode. And it did that by making a system call. And it turns out that on the Unix systems of the time, OX3B was the system call number for execv, which is, if you check in CS02, exec sound is the system call for running a new program. We have to set the arguments. And so they did, as shellcode often does, they pushed a string to the stack. So these two push instructions write the string bin/bin/sh, the location of the command interpreter, to the stack. They copy the stack pointer to the temporary register 10. So register 10 now has a pointer to that string. Then they pushed the arguments to the system call to the stack, because that was the calling convention on the PDP-11 with Unix. So they push the 1, 2, 3 arguments, including the file name to run, and I think gather the number of arguments, and then you pass an argument pointer in the way the system calls worked, and run these construction to run the OS with a request for operation OX3B for execute a break. So once that ran, the Morris worm, you know, would have a shell that was accepting input from the network, so it just ran commands to install itself. And that's kind of common pattern when people actually do these exploits in practice, is that they won't write the shell code that like does the whole malware thing. It just runs an installer, basically. Runs enough so they can run an installer in this case. So it doesn't even run the installer, it runs a shell. They use the shell to basically install it by typing commands into the shell. And also this dealt with that this was kind of a generic strategy that they have. The Morris worm actually did 3 different ways of infecting a system. And all of them ended up giving you a shell. So the code after you got the shell was the same for both all these 3 ways. And they worked 3 very different ways. So there was this buffer overflow in the finger program. Also the send mail program that also accepted mail had a command injection vulnerability that the Morris worm exploited. And it also just logged in with guest passwords. So all of these techniques ended up giving you a shell, and they had generic code once you got a shell through any of these 3 techniques. And we talked earlier on about stealth, you know, about sort of like rootkit style hiding yourself from the system. Well, the Morris worm, like a lot of malware, like it didn't really hide itself, but it installed itself with the file name usertempsh. The idea being that someone looking at a list of processes would say, oh, that's just the shell, because the shell is called sh. It's not usertemp, but it's called sh, so it blended in. You know, and that's kind of the it's not a rootkit, but it's, you know, still subtle. malware commonly does. So questions about our kind of quick overview of the Morris worm as an example of this idea. So the big thing we're seeing is like it has this strategy of we know where the stuff on the stack is after the buffer, we just fill that in the pointers we want. So one issue you might have is that if we look at this exploit, we're kind of depending on being able to put a bunch of characters you might imagine we probably just shouldn't accept as input for a normal string. And you might say, well, isn't that a problem, right? If my buffer overflow is from doing, say, scanf %s into a buffer, surely I can't just put arbitrary machine code there, right? There's restrictions. And for scanf, this is not actually a huge problem. It matches a sequence of non-white space characters. So we can't, there are real restrictions. So we can't use a space and all or ASCII white space characters. And it turns out that nulls weren't a restriction. But you might imagine a way you try to fix this problem is you might say, well, we really just shouldn't allow you to input nulls into %s. It's clearly not useful. And we might imagine that, maybe you try to avoid buffer overflows by saying, well, let's just not allow nulls to be input. Just patch all the functions to do that, or patch our code when it calls scanf to modify the input patterns to not accept nulls. So we can transform our machine code to not contain certain characters. And I'll start with how do we make it not contain nulls. And then I won't go into the full details of like, how can we get it not to contain pretty much anything special. And if we think of the machine code I showed you for our print a message and exit from earlier, this was our virus code basically from the tricky assignment. This is the tricky virus code that we gave you. It has a lot of zeros. So it seems like we can filter it out by removing all the zeros. And most of these zeros are from encodings of constants. And so if you want to get rid of those zeros, we can think of writing our instructions in ways where our constants won't be encoded this way. So here's a writing where we won't end up with zeros. So the first problem I had was this LEA, and this was saying here, 0x15 bytes after this instruction. It was pointing basically over right here where the string was after our machine code. So to avoid that being a problem, I made it be before. So it's going to be encoded as a negative number. If you remember how negative numbers work in 2's complement, that's going to have lots of 1 bits. It's not going to have zeros in it. Then I need to set EAX and EDI to specific values, and I want to do that without any 0 bytes. And my problem in my original machine code is as I was using the 4-byte move instructions, and to put 1 in 4 bytes, I have a bunch of 0 bytes. So my solution is not to use the 4-byte move instructions. Instead, I use XOR to clear the registers and then move 1 byte into the bottom part. So this gives us machine code where we got rid of all those zeros from the normal constants, and we have our relative offset is now encoded without any zeros either. So that's the work of getting rid of all my zeros from this machine code. But some other things seem a little tricky. So there's kind of some general strategies we can use for constants But then we need to think about what about opcodes that contain bad things. So for constants, so one issue you might have is like here, you know, I'm moving the value 1 and 2, 5. You know, if one of those characters was prohibited, what do I do about that? Anyone have an idea? So let's say, for example, I wanted to do move B of 0x10 into AL. But with scanf, I'd have a problem because this is 0xA. What could I do to have that not be encoded, have to do the equivalent of that, but have not no 0xA? Okay, so we could, instead we could say add, I should write this 0xA so it's clear what I'm saying here. So instead we could say like 0x9AL and add like 0x1AL. Yeah, so that's one strategy. And kind of a generic strategy is I can just write it as a bunch of XORs and INCs, for example. And we can come up with similar patterns for a lot of operations. So we just need to think of like what is our actual subset of machine code that is kind of useful to put in. Useful, but is possible with all our restrictions. And I just showed us dealing with, you know, OXA and, you know, other things like that. So maybe we want to have, you know, like normal input characters. And it turns out that the way x86 encoding works out, that if we just look at operations which are encoded with normal input characters, it's actually pretty useful. So we can get various forms of XOR with constants. So including with constants, we can do push, pop, increment, and decrement of registers. We can push a 1 byte constant. We have to be able to encode that 1 byte in the allowed characters, but we can get a starting point. We can include the rex prefix to use RAX instead of EAX, so on. And we can do conditional jumps. Now, this seems to have a big problem with respect to the machine code I showed you earlier, the shellcode, is that there's, you know, some operations here which fundamentally are not possible. Like, so these moves, for example, well, we can simulate them with some combination of push, pop, increment, decrement. We can make that happen. So all our arithmetic is basically handled, you know, all our setting values we can do with a push, pop, increment, decrement, and XOR. Like, yes, it might be a lot of code to do it some ways, but, you know, we can make that happen. But what seems really hard is, what about this syscall? How do we do that? And a big trick we can use is that we can write machine code on the stack and then jump to it, go to it. And if we think about how our sort of stack smashing pattern works, typically we overwrote a return address here and our shell code is before it. So if we think of what's going to happen after our shell code finishes executing, it's going to go to the last thing we pushed onto the stack. So even though it seems like our kind of allowed list of operations doesn't allow anything interesting like system calls, well, we can just push the bytes that correspond to that machine code onto the stack and end up executing it. And so that kind of lets us, I'm not going to go through all the processes. You can look up what people have done, but that lets you kind of write our shell code in a way where it fits into kind of almost, not entirely, but almost an arbitrary set of possible bytes. And this means that the strategy of saying, well, wasn't it too easy that you could scanf all these funny characters, doesn't, you know, fixing that problem won't stop the attack. And I guess since I did look in preparation for this at some examples of people doing this, another notable example of an instruction that's possible is IMAL with a constant is also possible. So that's a way you can get big numbers relatively easily. You could also get big numbers by popping the 32-bit value and working from there. So using this, it's possible. So because we can write the machine code to the stack and start running it, we can end up executing, you know, any instructions. We aren't actually restricted by, you know, anything with the bytes there, practically speaking. Now, there's a place you might think we have a bigger problem. And that's that when we wrote our initial shellcode, you know, we have to have overwritten the return address correctly. And we had a lot less flexibility with our address. With our shellcode, we can write it pretty much however we want, as long as it's, we can find some instructions that, you know, have the correct machine code. You know, we can make it work, and because there's lots of ways of writing any, you know, piece of assembly that's equivalent, there's tons of options for that. But for the address, there's not tons of options. It has to be in the stuff we inputted. And what we've been showing so far is, like, we go into the debugger, we find out where the buffer is, and we have to put exactly those bytes in our buffer where the return address will be overwritten. So if our buffer pointer is 7FFFFD2C, so this is like a value you might actually get on Linux with address space randomization disabled, we have some issues. And some of these are we can deal with. So these zeros here, these aren't really a problem because most likely the original return address already has those there. So we just don't overwrite. That's not probably not an issue. And these bytes are probably something we can work around by just changing where in the buffer our shellcode is, because those are the low order bytes. So remember, this is little endian, so the lowest, least significant part is first. So like if we don't like 2C, we can use, you know, 2D, 2F. And that should, you know, just means we have to shift our shellcode over a few bytes. No big deal. And if we don't like the DE, we can use like DF or E0 very easily, and possibly much bigger values if we're willing to have a lot more space in our buffer used for padding or NOPS lines. But it seems like we kind of have a fundamental issue with this stuff here, right? We kind of have to have it be on the stack, and addresses that are on the stack are kind of going to look like that. And the original return address is not going to be on the stack, so we have to put those there. Like, isn't it going to be a problem for us? And maybe couldn't we stop this attack entirely by just modifying scanf, fgs, all the input functions to just say if it's text input, these characters don't exist. And maybe 7F, that like corresponds to like a character you can read, but FF doesn't. We can just get rid of that. Or maybe we can just intentionally locate the stack at a place which always has funny characters in it. Okay. And just deny those characters for input. So as an attacker, you know, if you can't input this address, what might be some alternatives? Like what other addresses could be useful? So why did we choose, why did we want to input this address? What's special about it, this address, that makes us want to have replace the return address with it? Yeah?
That's where
the code we have put in via the buffer overflow is. So that's where the code we have put in is. So that's where our input went. So the important part is this is where our input went. So if there are other places our input went, those are also valid targets. So the stack snatching pattern says we just assume our input only goes to the stack. But if that's a limitation, like very often, we can kind of practically work around this by observing that, you know, sometimes our input also goes to other places. So for example, here I have a buffer overflow, but I'm only accepting a restricted set of characters. But I also have a string that maybe I can control. And if that string happens to be located at a pretty realistic address, maybe that address, I can write those bytes over the return address and have things work. So we can look for other buffers to put our shellcode in that maybe aren't on the stack. We can try to find a buffer which has an acceptable address. So our attacker doesn't need to be limited by the address of that buffer, that address of that buffer on the stack. We can find any. We can execute the attack. I have my here, right? Our normal attack is we like return to the buffer. The attack works the same if I have some other, you know, global variable and we return into that. So if there's any part of memory that we can control the value of and we know the address, we can figure out the address of, that's a valid target, and that's a way we can work around, you know, what if you can't put a pointer in? Well, what pointers? Like, you have to disallow somehow all pointers that to stuff that contains user input, not just ones for the stack. So questions about this idea, you know, we have these two things that kind of mean that this idea, you know, this kind of intuitive idea that, you know, these buffer overflows involve inputting weird characters, therefore disallow weird characters input. The kind of two reasons that doesn't really work in practice. So one reason is that part of the weird characters we need to enter was shellcode. The shellcode can be written with a lot of extra effort, but it can be written without any weird characters. And the other part of the weird characters was our address to overwrite, and we can often find addresses which don't have weird characters where we can jump to and control what's there. Because the program doesn't only keep things on the stack, it keeps things in all sorts of places in its memory. And not all of those are going to have addresses you can easily filter out. Because, like, for example, like, this is an address that, without position-independent code, you typically end up finding for a global variable on Linux, and it's just valid ASCII characters if you write it out as ASCII. So questions? On this. Okay, so in our remaining 20 minutes, I'm going to talk about some more effective and very common ways of mitigating stack smashing. And because filtering the input isn't really good enough, these ideas were kind of the first thing people did, and they're focused on protecting the return address. But the key problem we have is that the return address gets overwritten, and we just use it, rather than somehow noticing that something's wrong and stopping. So these mitigations I'm going to talk about are focused on somehow saying, oops, this return address is broken, let's not use it. And if you look at code generated by a typical compiler, you'll see stuff that, if you don't turn it off, that implements something known as stack canaries. And kind of the code for that, you know, this is an example you might see, is we load a value from thread local storage. We talked about FS being the thread local storage pointer. And we copy that onto the stack and then clear it from our register. And then we copy from the stack and compare it with the value in that thread local storage. And if it fails, we jump to this, you know, stack check fail function, which it turns out crashes our program. So the purpose here is that we have a secret value known as a stack canary that we're going to store just before the return address. And we're doing some things to be really careful with that value. So for example, we have this clear of XOR here. And that's there so that if code here is buggy and leaks the value of EAX from like an uninitialized variable, it doesn't see that value. We don't want people to learn that value. And you can see also when we do the comparison, we do it not with test, but with XOR. So we clear EAX of that value. So again, it's not going to accidentally leak. And here, we're using REX for it, which presumably means the function returns void. If it doesn't return void, you have to use a different register. So questions on... So the idea here is we're putting a value on the stack and making sure it didn't change. Yeah?
How are stack canaries generated? Is it possible to predict the value of the stack canary?
How are stack canaries generated? So we haven't talked about that explicitly, but we know they're in thread local storage. So that's going to be presumably initialized by the startup code. Probably whatever code calls main is going to set up that value. And if we think of how these are used, well, you know, what we want to happen is that if we execute our stack smashing pattern, we have a canary value here. And if you do your stack smashing attack, you overwrite the canary, and the hope is that you don't know anything valid to overwrite it with. So obviously, if we could figure out this value, we could make this just work. So the point of it is that we shouldn't be able to figure out the value, and we overwrite it wrong almost all the time. So the best way to achieve that is to choose a random value. And choose a different random value every time. So this idea is known as stack canaries. It's named after the sort of canary in a coal mine, that the stack canary being set to a different value by the stack smashing attack tells us something is wrong. And this means our generic stack smashing pattern no longer works because we need to guess this canary value and we need to guess a different value for each program each time it runs. Questions? So for this mitigation to be successful, you know, we want to, you know, the key thing we're depending on is that we're relying on the way our buffer overflows work, it being the case that overwriting the return address implies that we also overwrite this canary. And the way we're setting that up is we're putting the canary just before the return address. So one way we'll talk about later that this, you know, might not work out is if there's some way of overwriting things where we don't write every byte from the beginning of the buffer to the return address, if there's something where we, you know, write to the middle of a buffer, where the middle might actually mean starting past the end, you know, that kind of bug, then stack canaries might not help. And You know, but our assumption is that usually we have, in order to overwrite the return address, we have to overwrite what's just before it. And the other thing we're depending on is that the canary is a secret value. That if the canary was always some constant, then we just put that in our stack smashing attack. We know exactly where to put it because we know where the return address is to do the attack. That's no problem. And as I mentioned, our good choice is it should be random. Not all implementations of this idea use a random stack canary, but it should be random. And if you look at what the GNU/libc library, the most popular implementation of this on Linux, does, is they also put in some special characters in the canary to make it harder to put in buffers that are overflowed. So they deliberately put a null byte and a newline byte and an FF byte, just because it's somewhat likely you'll have trouble inputting those. So even if you know the canary, often you won't be able to actually put it usefully in your buffer. So questions? And so this, you know, idea is very old. And as I mentioned, like, stack smashing became really popular in the 90s. So in 1998, there was a paper proposing this strategy, and eventually it kind of got into most compilers. And eventually it moved from being an option in those compilers to a default in those compilers. So for example, in GCC, there's a bunch of options that start with stack protector, which differ in how often they use a stack canary. So why wouldn't we just use it in every single function? Why don't compilers do it? Yeah. Performance overhead. What's the performance? Why? What's the performance overhead?
We have to access the local storage and then add a couple of extra instructions at the end to compare.
Okay. Yeah. So we have a few extra instructions. We also have a few extra memory accesses. And the big concern is that for little functions, this doesn't really make sense. And that was kind of a notable thing about when they looked at the paper, you know, that if we only apply this to risky functions, like functions which have a character array declared in them and so on, the overhead is very modest, or kind of modest. So I guess a theme we'll see in this course is, you say, like, 1% untime overhead. That's no big deal. Not everyone thinks that way. Some people look at a change which adds 1% or 2% overhead and say, gosh, we can't ship this. This is not acceptable for our compiler to have this performance regression, and we won't do this. So there's a bunch of proposals we might talk about later where you might think that's worth it, and people in reality didn't. But stack canaries, when applied with this kind of risky function strategy, did pass the bar, and everyone pretty much implements them now. If you just apply them blindly to every function, well, there's lots of functions which are pretty trivial and small, and you actually get a very high overhead. So you have the additional instructions. You also have, like, that some registers might be used that weren't otherwise, which was probably more of a problem in the 90s, because we had 32-bit systems with 8 less registers. And also, another concern you might have is space. That we're pushing an extra value onto the stack in every function that uses this. So if you want to use minimal stack space, this doesn't do it. We're deliberately wasting stack space. Now, as we saw, we probably weren't really concerned about that given that our compiler was like padding our 100-byte character array with an extra 12 bytes. But, you know, if we're thinking of like an embedded system, maybe this isn't really acceptable then. So, stack canaries, really nice, you know, simple change that is the primary reason why, if you have a program compiled with a modern compiler, typically you can't just do stack smashing anymore. And it's really nice in that it's pretty low overhead. It has no change to the calling convention. So we're going to talk about some other ways of preventing stack smashing where you can't just like have one library add the mitigation and then use it from something else. With Stack Canaries, that's entirely possible. There's no change in how the function works. It just pushes and pops an extra thing from the stack. And also, Stack Canaries, you know, didn't require us to like modify any of our C code. We could still use all our horribly insecure C code written exactly the way it was. We didn't even need to modify like scanf to change how it accepts its input. It works exactly the same way when we're not overwriting return addresses. We just recompile and we get this protection. There's some things which aren't so great about it. So one is that, you know, if we have existing programs, this idea pretty much helps us not. Right, so the change has to be to the function with the return address which is overflowed. So even though like getS is overwriting it, getS isn't checking the stack canary, it's the function that calls getS, because that's whose return address we overwrite. So like we can't like fix the library functions that might overflow buffers and have other programs take advantage of that. The programs need to be recompiled to use this. The other big issue is that we're going to talk about all the ways of exploiting buffer overflows that don't rely on return addresses on the stack. And kind of a big discovery that was made after people used these kind of patches to work around stack smashing is that, yeah, stack smashing isn't the only way of doing it. That there's patterns that you can still do consistently. They're a bit more work than stack smashing, but that still mean that these buffer overflows are still going to be exploitable in practice in most real circumstances. It's just less obvious than the stack smashing case and less generic. Yeah, we're going to have to think more about exactly what the program does to do that. And the other biggest issue with Stack Canaries is that it's vulnerable to what we know as information leaks. That if the program leaks values it's not supposed to, if it prints out values from the stack that are supposed to be junk, it might print out the Stack Canary. And the same sort of programs which don't check whether their input overflows a buffer often have these kinds of bugs where they'll accidentally print things out that are like random memory locations. So we can take a bug which previously was just we're reading some value we're not supposed to, and it will be the tool we use to turn that into arbitrary code execution. So this like turns a read value bug into execute code bug. Right, and normally we think of those kind of reading a value we're not supposed to, yeah, it's a security problem, but normally we wouldn't think of that as a super high priority security problem. But if stack canaries are what's keeping us from writing arbitrary code, it is. So we're going to talk about a bunch of what I'll call mitigations this semester. So by mitigations, I mean something to stop attacks. And something the term mitigation should get to is that these ways of stopping attacks aren't solving the real problem. And because they aren't solving the real problem, they tend to be incomplete solutions. And stack canaries are kind of incomplete solutions. And that's, you know, because we can kind of attack the two assumptions it makes. So one I alluded to earlier was that we kind of are assuming that when you overwrite the return address, you overwrite the canary. And with the simple buffer overflows we saw, that's how it worked. But often we have bugs of other patterns. So like here, for example, I have a bug where I don't check the bounds of my array correctly. So I have an array on the stack with 8 values. I use this check, which is, sorry, this is 4 times size event, which is not checking the size of the array correctly. And that means that I can overwrite scores of 8, 9, 10, and 11. So this program actually lets me overwrite the return address without touching the stack canary by just saying, I want to modify score number 10 and score number 11. And it's not uncommon for programs to have this kind of bug pattern instead of the simple overflow we looked at earlier. And yeah, we can use the same stack smashing pattern here. It's just that the way we overwrite the buffer is we do it piecemeal. We do it in these little chunks. In this case, that lets us overwrite the buffer and insert our shellcode without touching the stack canary in the middle. So this is one way in which our stack canaries are an incomplete solution to our problem. So as an example, if we want to set our score return address to this value, what score should I input? Okay.
And then set 11 to 3412.
2, 3, 4, 1, 2. Okay, so that's one proposal. Other proposals? Yes, you could. Why don't you solve it? So I see one problem here that we need to be careful with, which is you forgot about this. So I'll give people a minute to think over, like, what should we ask to set? Would you be able to write to the 12th index? Yes, you can. But so I guess first of what indexes should we write to? So I would say our stack canary is 8 and 9, assuming it's an 8-byte value. And our return address is 10 and 11. So writing to the 12th index is not useful. So that should also give us a hint that we better be writing 4 bytes with each value. I guess in the interest of time, I will through. So what is the bottom, what is the least significant 4 bytes of this number is these bytes, and the most significant 4 bytes is these bytes. And the way numbers are stored in Little Endian, the least significant 4 bytes are gonna be our first part of the value, our lowest address part, the next significant. So I would say, the solution I get is we want to store at index 10, we want to store 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, except we're going to need to convert that to decimal to input it. Like we're not going to be able to input OSX because that's not what CN accepts if you know C++. And at index 11, we're going to input 1. And that's how we'll set that return address. Questions about how I figured this out? Okay. So this same type of problem can give us, the same type of bug can also give us problems with the canary is secret problem. So one thing is that if we could read the score for 8 and 9, now we know what the stat canary is. And kind of importantly, we know what it is for any function. The other type of issue we have is that if we have an uninitialized variable and it's stored on the stack, well, the old value on the stack might be a stack canary. You know, and I might therefore learn, you know, that value that way. So that's where we'll leave off today. So next time we'll talk about another mitigation that tries to be better than stack canaries and use the same kind of strategy. We're protecting a return address, but it's going to do it in a way which should be more resilient than stack canaries that's also been proposed and used. And then we'll start talking about exploits where we don't care if how we retract the return address is, we just don't use it.